Okay, so why don't we get started? Few announcements. There is going to be a homework out today. Okay, it was supposed to be handed out yesterday, but because of the snow closure, we couldn't do that. So I'm going to put it up on the course webpage. Okay, it's due a week from today. That's one. Second thing is the next programming assignment, which is going to be on threads and synchronization. I'm hoping to have it ready early next week. Okay, I believe Tuesday is going to be Monday schedule, right? So there won't be a class on Tuesday, but I will put it up on Tuesday. Okay, and it will be discussed in the discussion section on Wednesday. Okay, so that, and that's due in 2 weeks. Okay, so that puts you towards the end of Feb time frame. And I had mentioned that there are going to be 2 midterms, 1 final. Okay, so I will have the midterm in early March. Okay, so the first one is early March, second one early April, okay, and then the final exam is in May. Okay, so 1 a month. Okay, I will announce the exact date. I am thinking of having it the week before spring break, the midterm. Okay, I will find a date. I will make sure that there is no problem with the date and announce it shortly. Okay, but just keep an eye. There's still few weeks to go. But I just wanted to get the overall schedule announced here with respect to the exams. Okay, so the first one is going to be in a few weeks from now. Okay, any questions about this? Okay, so let's continue from where we left off last time. So we were talking about allergies are acting up. We were talking about synchronization. And I wrapped up the discussion on CPU scheduling. We talked about MLFQ, multi-level feedback queue, and I introduced this new scheduler called lottery scheduling, a randomized scheduler that allows you to control how much CPU time each process gets, which is in proportional to the number of lottery tickets a user will assign to that application or process. Okay, and then we started talking about synchronization. The two key concepts that to keep in mind is this notion of mutual exclusion, which is basically whenever a thread does an activity, by doing that activity it explicitly prevents or excludes other threads from doing the same activity. Okay, this is called mutual exclusion. Critical section is essentially a piece of code that only one thread can access at any time, and if one thread is executing that code, other threads are prohibited from accessing and executing it. Okay? Critical sections are implemented using the notion of mutual exclusion. Okay? And the mechanisms that we saw that implements mutual exclusion, the first mechanism was that of lock. I gave this example of too much milk, and we saw what problems can arise in terms of interleaving and coordination, and basically we saw how locks can be used to address this issue. Okay? So basic thing to keep in mind are synchronization primitives. Okay, locks, and today we'll look at semaphores. Allow only one thread to execute and others have to wait. Okay, so waiting is basically what allows you to do synchronization. So waiting is always part of any synchronization mechanism. So today we'll look at how to implement locks. Okay, last time I mentioned what locks are. Okay, but this is a course on operating system, not on programming. Okay, so we really are interested in what operating systems will do to implement locks. Okay, what hardware features are needed, what does the OS do this, okay, to provide this feature. Okay, we look at three different techniques, okay, to implement locks. One is disabling interrupts. We'll use see the test and set instruction, and we'll see busy wait based solutions. And then I'll introduce the next primitive, which is semaphores. Okay, last time I mentioned semaphores are a generalization of locks. We will see why that is the case. Okay, what can semaphores do that allow it to be a generalization? Okay, so we'll look at two types of semaphore, what's called a binary semaphore, okay, also called a mutex, and a counting semaphore. Okay, so we'll come to that shortly. Let's first look at locks and hardware support. So if you go back several classes, right, when I stopped giving you this high-level introduction on computer architecture, I mentioned there are several hardware features that are used for implementing synchronization. So these are the three that were mentioned at that point, and today we'll see how these are actually used to implement logs. Okay, so the first one is atomic loads and stores, and we already looked at a little bit of this last time. The one that we'll really use to implement logs is the feature that allows you to interrupt or rather disable interrupts, and then we'll look at test and set instructions. Okay, and all of these features are used to implement all synchronization mechanisms. Today we'll only look at logs, okay, but the same ideas can be used to implement semaphores, monitors, and send and receive, atomic sends and receives. Yeah, so let's try to understand what disabling interrupts does, and then we'll see how you can use it to implement logs. Okay, so typically, okay, so whenever you have a set of processes or threads that are getting scheduled by the operating system kernel, we have this notion of a time slice. We assume you have a preemptive scheduler, so there is this notion of a time slice. Whenever the time slice expires, the thread or the process that is running on the processor has to give up the processor. Okay, so there is always the CPU scheduler can always get control whenever the time slice expires. That's number one. Or the thread or process has to do some IO and block and voluntarily give up the CPU. Okay, in either of these two cases, okay, the CPU scheduler is going to get control and run some other process. Okay, now if we are in a critical section, okay, and we want to ensure that when this code is being executed, nothing else is being executed, we want to ensure also that the CPU scheduler does not get control and start running some other process. Okay, so one way to explicitly ensure that if this thread is executing this piece of code, nobody else can execute it, is to not execute any other thread. Okay, if you don't execute any other thread, by definition you are guaranteed. Okay, on a single core system, okay, on multi-core system this is not true, but on a single core system you are guaranteed that if nothing else is executing, then only this process is executing. So this is a critical section. Okay, so then the question is, how do you prevent the CPU scheduler from making this thread relinquish the CPU? Okay, so then you have to prevent either of these two types of events, the internal events or external events, from allowing the CPU, the scheduler, to run. Okay, so internal events are easy. Within a critical section, don't do IO. Okay, this will prevent you from blocking if you are not doing IO. Okay, so that's simple. The external events is where the notion of disabling interrupts comes into the place. Okay, so everything including the time slice, okay, all of these things that cause the scheduler to run are implemented using interrupts. Okay, the time slice is typically implemented by setting a timer. Okay, of whatever the time slice is, if it's 100 milliseconds, when the timer goes off, that raises an interrupt. Okay, that causes the scheduler to run, and then it basically runs another process. Okay, and this is true for any interrupt. So one way to prevent the scheduler from running is to temporarily disable interrupts on the machine. Okay, disabling interrupt basically means that even if an interrupt actually occurs, the interrupt is not going to get delivered. Okay, so essentially you are masking interrupts temporarily. This is a hardware feature that your processor already supports. Your processor actually supports this notion of temporarily masking or disabling interrupts, but that means that even if that interrupt were to occur, there is no action taken. Okay, so if you could do this temporarily, then you could prevent the scheduler from running and implement this notion of a critical section. So here is pseudo code that shows you how you could implement a class that implements logs using disabling interrupts. Excuse me. So here, as I said, any log implementation has two methods, acquire and release. Okay, acquire is the method that allows you to grab the log, and if the log is in use, then you wait. Release basically releases the log that you already acquired. Okay, this is the constructor. Okay, that's the value of the log. Okay, so there are two private variables here. That's the value of the log, which says is the log free or not free. And there's a queue. Okay, we'll see what the queue does. So initially the value is free. Okay, you just mark it as zero. The queue is empty. Okay, so this is what acquires does. Okay, so you disable the interrupts, okay, at the beginning of the method, and you enable it. So this entire method will run without the scheduler interrupting this method. Okay, anything that is executing this method, essentially this becomes a critical section. It's executing, there are no interrupts, So nothing can cause the scheduler to run and start running some other task. Okay, so when something is executing this piece of code, it will all execute to completion, meaning it will execute through the method. Okay, is that clear what disabling interrupts will do here? So now let's see what the acquire itself does. Okay, so it checks, is the lock busy? I mean, is the lock already taken? Okay, if that lock is taken, then you have to block. That's the semantics of the lock. Okay, this is a blocking call. If the lock is available, which is else, then you just mark it busy and you grab the lock and you are done. If the lock is taken, then you are going to have to wait. So here is where you add the thread to this queue of threads that are waiting to acquire the lock. So you add this to the queue and then you make the thread sleep. Yeah, so the thread is blocked until the lock becomes available. Okay, so you keep track of who was asked to acquire the lock by adding this thread ID to a queue, okay, internal queue, and then you make the thread sleep. Okay, that's how acquire is implemented. Any questions here? Yeah, I'll come to some questions that I have of whether this works in just a moment, but let's look at release. Okay. Release does the opposite. Okay, you will basically disable the interrupts as usual. And then if you're trying to release the lock, you first check if this queue is not empty. If somebody is waiting, then you have to get one of these threads and give the lock to that thread. Okay, that's what this does. So it takes the first thread of the queue, puts it on the ready queue, basically wakes it up. Okay, there is a sleep there, so you wake up that thread saying you can have the lock now. Okay, if the thread queue is empty, which means there is no one else waiting on the lock, you just mark the lock as free and you are done. Okay, you just release the lock. Okay, and then you re-enable the interrupts at the end. Okay, so this piece of code is a critical section because you have disabled interrupts here and you have enabled interrupts there. Okay, is this clear what disabling interrupts will do? Okay, so now let's come back to this acquire method. Okay. So the basic question is, you have disabled interrupts here. Okay, and assume that the lock is already taken. Okay, if the lock was not taken, then you would just mark the value as busy, re-enable interrupts, and the thread will continue execution, the thread that is trying to acquire the lock. Okay, but if on the other hand the lock is taken, then you put the thread ID on the queue and you sleep. Yes. So if you sleep here, you are blocked here. Right? The thread that has called this code, okay, is itself gone to sleep. Put that thread to sleep. Okay, so interrupts are still disabled, as was just pointed out here. Is that a problem? Yes, it's a problem, right? I mean, if you shouldn't really leave the interrupt disabled on the system for a long period of time. Okay, so you have to understand. So then the question is, where do these interrupts, is this code correct? Where does the interrupt get re-enabled? Okay, so that's what's on the next slide, saying when should the acquire re-enable interrupt before putting a thread to sleep. So you clearly don't want to do this before you add the thread to the wait queue. Okay, so if you inserted re-enable interrupts here, okay, you haven't gone to sleep yet. Okay, so if you re-enable interrupt, then your timer can go off and this thing can run and it can start mucking around with the queue and assume that there is nothing in the queue and make some incorrect decisions. Okay, so clearly you shouldn't do that here. Okay, now if you do this just before you go to sleep, again you have the same problem. The thread hasn't even slept yet. Okay, and it is not yet on the ready queue, still on the run queue. Okay, and here basically you will try to go and take it off that queue and put it on the ready queue. So again you have a problem here. Okay, so you shouldn't really try to re-enable interrupts while you are doing this. This is still in the critical section. So you shouldn't just say I'm going to put this thread to sleep, and if I just enable interrupts just before I put this to sleep or just before I put the thread on this queue. Yeah, because both of those will give you incorrect execution. Yeah, bad things will happen if the interleaving of this code goes wrong. Yeah, it violates safety properties. Yes, and the question is, so what do you do? You let it sleep, interrupts are still disabled. If you try to re-enable interrupt before you put it to sleep, you have a correctness problem. Sorry? Yeah, after you go to sleep, you re-enable interrupt. So the question is, how do you do it? This is the code that has to execute, right? The thread that has called acquire is executing this code. We just put that thread to sleep. So now, who is going to re-enable the interrupts? Clearly, you should do it after. The answer is right, but you cannot do it because you just put yourself to sleep. So these are some subtleties that you have to keep in mind when you... This is a really OS level code, not application level code. But you can see that implementation is not as trivial as it looks. I mean, all this pseudocode looks fine, but there is this issue of what happens when you put the thread to sleep and so on. So the answer really is you don't really re-enable interrupts. You let someone else do it for you. Okay, so this is basically what happens. So the assumption is you have gone to sleep because some other thread holds the lock. So you just go to sleep, okay, and you assume that you will switch to this other thread that is going to execute the critical section and call release. Okay. When you call release, it will enable the re-enable the interrupts for you. You don't need to do it. Okay. So the transfer, the code, the thread B code starts running after you put thread A to sleep, and it will eventually call release. So it will basically run this code. The queue is not empty. It will take the thread off the queue. It will put it on the ready queue and it will enable the interrupts for you. Okay. So that is how this will work. Yeah, so now, so that's what is shown here. So now you basically, when this does a release, it will enable interrupts. And that's why this will work at all. Okay. It's not ideal. Yeah, because it is not guaranteed that the CPU scheduler has to pick this thread to run next. Because it could pick some arbitrary thread C and interrupts are disabled, things could go wrong. Okay, that thread might want to do I/O and none of the I/O interrupts are coming back into the system and so on. Okay, this will only work if really the scheduler picks the other thread that was actually holding the lock, that thread executes its critical section, it does a release, and then you re-enable interrupts because of that release. Okay, because there is a re-enable interrupt here. Okay, this will cause the system-wide interrupts to be re-enabled. Okay, so this is one way to do it. Okay, it is not necessarily the ideal way. There are other ways to do it as well. Yeah, but so the point is, implementing locks by disabling interrupts is tricky. Yeah, because you have to really pay attention to when you re-enable the interrupts and not leave the interrupts disabled for long periods of time. Okay, we'll see other implementations that are much cleaner than this. Okay, so this is, the point is, this is not as simple as it looks because there are subtleties that you have to deal with. The other problem, of course, is with multiprocessor, this is going to be a problem. In any case, here we have assumed that there's only one thread running. Okay, if there are multiple processors, then we are really not worried about if both threads are running at the same time, then what happens? So if you disable interrupts on one processor, the other core still might be receiving interrupts. So none of this will work in that case. So that's something. So this is works on uniprocessor. Okay, multiprocessors, it will not work. Okay, is that clear? Any questions on this? Okay. So now we'll see another implementation that's much better, can also deal with multiprocessor. This uses another hardware feature. Okay, this uses what are called atomic read modify write instruction. Okay. Most processors support at least one instruction of this category. Okay. And what does that instruction do? That's basically doing multiple operations all in a single instruction. Okay. So what these instructions can do is they can read a value either from memory or from register, okay, check the value against something, okay, and if necessary modify that value. Okay, write back to that value, all in a single instruction. Okay, otherwise, this would be multiple instructions. You read a value of a register, you do an if, you check, and you modify. Okay, so the sequence of instructions are executed as a single atomic instruction. Okay, and this is often referred to as the canonical form of this instruction is called a test and set. To test the value and you set. Okay, that's a form of read modify, right? There are other forms here on other architectures which basically do the same thing. Something called a conditional exchange, compare and swap. We'll not worry about this. We'll just use this as a canonical example. Okay. So what does this do? Okay. So a test and set instruction can read a value, okay, and then write one back to memory. Okay. So it's basically just checking whether the value of some variable is 1. Okay. And if it is, then it's going to write 1. Okay. So it will test the value, check it, and if so, it will write 1. And we'll see how to use this in just a moment. Okay. Now this does require hardware level support. This assembly instruction should be supported by your processor. And this also works on multiprocessors, but it requires additional support. Okay. If the value of that variable is cached in the processor caches of other cores, then you should be able to invalidate it in order for you to execute this atomically. Because if that processor also executes test and set at the same time, you still want it to be atomic. Okay. So here is how this would work. You would implement your lock class. Okay, so we'll use the test and set, which basically reads the value and writes one back to memory and returns the old value. Okay, that's what this instruction is going to do. Okay, you have the same acquire and release class. Here is the value of your lock. Okay, initially you basically, the constructor is just saying lock is available, and that's your acquire method. Okay, single instruction, single while loop. Okay, it just says while test and set of value equal to 1. Then just keep looping. Okay, what does that do? Did you ever do test and set in 201? No? Okay.
Well, it writes more on the memory, so if any other instruction sees that it's 1, it just waits until the value is actually in there. It's like the RAID register value.
Right. Okay, so that's basically right. So let's look at what is this test and set value going to do. It's going to check the value of the variable called value and return that value. And it is going to set it to 1. That's what the instruction does. Right? It reads the value, okay, writes 1 back to that variable and returns the value that it read. That's what it said there. Okay? So what will this do? So let's assume that this value is 0 initially. Okay? The lock is available. Some thread calls acquire. What does the test and set value, what does this do? Not the while loop, just this. It will read the value of that variable. What is the value? It's 0. That's what you set it to. That's what this will return. It'll return 0. Okay? And it will write back 1. Okay, it'll write back that value now becomes 1 and it returns 0. Okay, what will the while loop do? Will it wait? Test and set return 0. So it's checking 0 equal to 1. It's going to fail, right? So it will exit. Okay, if the lock is available, then it is just going to set the lock to be busy and exit. That's what that instruction does. Okay, is that clear? Okay. Let's suppose the lock was in use. So some other thread has already marked the value to be 1. Okay, what will that do? What is test and set going to return? Okay, if the value is 1, it will return 1. What will it write back? Okay, it will write back 1. So it's just reading 1 and writing 1. Basically, it's not changing the value of that variable. Okay, it's going to do this atomically. And so what does that do to the while loop? It will loop. So it's just checking, is the value 1? If the value is 1, it will just keep spinning. Okay, so what does that do to the thread? The thread that is trying to acquire the lock is just sitting in this while loop spinning. Okay, it's not going to get the lock. It is just going to be stuck here just doing what is called busy waiting. Okay, when will it exit this while loop? Okay, Okay, it will be exited when the thread that holds the lock calls release and sets the value to zero. Once the value is set to zero, that test and set, the subsequent call of this test and set will actually read zero. Okay, and it will write back one, which will cause the while loop to exit. So if the value is in use, I mean the lock is in use, any acquire will sit there in a while loop until the lock is released. Yeah, that's exactly the semantics we want. If the lock is available, just grab it, so, and then just mark it as in use. Okay, that's what this does. And if the lock is in use, then you have to wait. Okay, much simpler code. Makes use of this hardware feature called test and set instruction. Okay, works on multiprocessor because the hardware guarantees to you that this is going to be done atomically. Okay, so even if there are multiple processors and there are multiple acquires being called, it all works fine. Okay, because each test and set will execute atomically. Okay, that's the guarantee that the hardware has provided to you. So you don't need to worry about what happens if thread A calls test and set here and thread B also calls test and set. It doesn't matter. Only one of them will execute at any given instant. Okay, so correctness is guaranteed. Okay, so all of what I said is already said here. You just read this, you probably understand what it is doing. Any questions on this? So this is how you would implement locks internally using this hardware feature of test and set. This is a good implementation. Okay, the while loop just keeps spinning. If the lock is in use, so this thread that is basically trying to acquire the lock is just sitting and spinning and wasting CPU cycles. Shouldn't really have to do that. Okay. It's better than disabling interrupts. Okay. Cleaner code, works on multiprocessor, okay, but has a limitation. Limitation is, it is basically doing what is called busy wait. Okay. So this is the problem, this while loop. Very simple, but essentially it is causing the CPU to waste cycles where the thread keeps checking. Okay, it might check thousands of times, millions of times. It depends on how long the other thread is going to take to release. Okay, so you will have wasted all these instructions that you executed that don't really achieve anything. So what can we do? Okay, so you can signal. So we'll look at two solutions. First one is where you still have busy waiting. So by this time it should be clear that busy waiting is not a good thing. So any solution that implements busy wait essentially wastes CPU cycles. So you want to avoid it altogether or minimize it as much as possible. Okay. Here is a solution that doesn't avoid it, okay, but minimizes the impact. Okay, so what does this do? Okay, so now your acquire and release methods are becoming a little more complex, but they're essentially doing the same thing. So rather than busy waiting on the value of the lock, okay, we will busy wait on another variable called guard. Okay, all that the guard is doing is it's guarding the execution of this method. Okay, all this. So what that means is if some thread is already executing, is in this method, this guard prevents any other thread from entering this method altogether. Okay, that's all this guard is going to do. It's not doing anything to the lock itself. Okay, it's just guarding entry to this method. So if one thread is executing, it knows that some thread is executing, it prevents anyone else from going in. Okay, how does it do that? Okay, so you just use a variable called guard. Okay, you initialize it to zero, like before. Okay, and then you just put a test and set on guard, okay, at the beginning of the acquire method. Okay, you do the same thing for the release method. Okay. So not only are you protecting just the acquire, but if any thread is either in acquire or in release, all other threads have to block. Not block, but they cannot enter. They will busy wait. Okay, so how do you busy wait here? So let's assume the first thread goes in and calls acquire. Okay. Guard is 0. Okay. So test and set will return 0. It will set guard to 1, the value of guard to 1. Okay, and the while loop will exit. Okay, the first thread has entered and it's executing the acquire code. Okay, that much is clear, right? So what happens is the second thread calls acquire. The first thread is somewhere here. Second thread calls acquire. What does it do? So it will come and execute this while loop. Okay, what does that do to the second thread? What's the value of guard? Okay, value of guard is 1. What will test and set return? Return 1. Okay, so what does that do to the while loop? Okay, the condition matches, so the second thread will just sit here and spin. So this guard has essentially prevented the second thread from entering this code. Okay, it's basically stuck here, it's spinning, it's executing. Okay, but it hasn't entered, it will just sit and spin here. Okay, so you will see that the last statement is resetting the guard. So the first thread that went in, once it's done here, it will reset the guard. That will cause the second thread that's sitting and spinning here to enter. Otherwise it just gets stuck here, it spins. Same is true of release. Okay, yes, question. Yes. So, what's the question now?
Won't that allow the other thread to come in
then? Yeah, so if, so here I haven't actually told you what this code does, I'm just explaining how guard works. So, now let's look at the code, I'll come to what you just said. So if initially the lock is available, all you do is you grab the lock, mark it busy, you say reset the guard and you're done. Okay, you acquired the lock. Now if some other thread has already acquired the lock and it's in the midst of its critical section, then the value is basically not free, so you will execute the if part. Okay, the if part basically says put the thread on the queue and put the thread to sleep. Okay, and then reset the guard so any other thread that was blocked here can enter. Okay, now this has to be done somewhat atomically. Okay, because if you do go to sleep, you haven't reset the guard, so then you're stuck, everybody is going to be stuck there. Okay. If you do this first, okay, then some other thread might come in and then it, you will basically be stuck. So you might want to protect this by disabling interrupts. Okay, so this code, if you really want to get it right, you have to disable interrupts for these two things, reset guard and re-enable. Okay, but is that what you were asking? Okay. Is this clear? So what is this doing? Okay, why is this still has busy wait? So the question is, why is this solution better? It is more complicated. Why is it better than this solution? Yeah. Yes. So the point is, this busy wait is waiting for just a few instructions. There's just an if and then you just do something very simple here. Okay? And then you get to go in. Okay? If you are busy waiting on the lock itself, you have no idea how much time, how much computation the thread will do before it does a release. In other words, if you are busy waiting on the lock itself, what you are busy waiting is on this code. So this could be arbitrarily long. It depends on what application you are writing. Okay, so you can protect any arbitrary length of code by a lock, by acquiring and doing a release. Okay, so you are going to busy wait until this large piece of code is executed in the previous solution. Here you are busy waiting on what you can see is actually a small piece of code. So this busy waiting will be smaller in length. So this is why we call it minimal waiting. Okay, you are still doing busy wait, but the amount of time you do it for is constrained here, okay, by some very simple code. Yeah, but in this case, if you busy wait on the lock itself, this is up to the application, okay, application programmer. You don't know how long you will have to busy wait. This could be of arbitrary length. Okay, so that will involve more waiting, okay, than this piece of code. Is that clear why this is a somewhat better solution? Not ideal, still involves busy wait, but more efficient than the previous solution. Okay, so the release code is, I didn't go into it, but it is basically doing the opposite. You have a guard thing here which allows only one thread to execute. The queue is not empty. You take it off the queue, put it on the ready queue, and that thread gets to go next. Otherwise, the value is marked to be free, okay, and the lock is available. So that's basically, we looked at three implementations of locks. Okay? We looked at locks that are implemented by the kernel using disabling interrupts. and re-enabling them. We looked at a test and set implementation which involved busy wait. We said that that's clean, but it has this problem of busy waiting, so it saw a solution where you reduce the amount of busy wait. So these are three implementations. There are others, okay, but this just give you some idea of how to do this. Okay, so before I talk about semaphores, I just want to show you Java's implementation of lock. So if you actually go to this package, util.concurrent, okay, there is a lock implementation in there. Okay, so if you look at it. So basically, it has two methods, lock and unlock. Okay, lock is same as acquire, unlock is same as release. Okay, this is how Java works. So that's basically how you would write your critical section. You have to declare a lock and you grab it, and then you put a try, and this is where your critical section is, and then when you're done, you release. Okay, so if you want to use locks in Java, that's basically the template that you will end up using. Okay, you will see that there are many other methods here. Okay, so there is try lock, and there is new condition, lock interrupt liability. You don't need to deal with that right now. So the main two methods are the lock, which acquires the lock, and unlock, which releases the lock. Okay, so those are the two key methods that you need to deal with. Okay, some of this we will come back to in the discussion section, and we'll have more sample code, but I just wanted to show you that Java does support locks. Okay, so the next synchronization primitive is called a semaphore. Okay, as I had mentioned, this will allow us to generalize locks and allow us to do more things. Okay, now what is a semaphore? It's basically an integer variable. Okay, that can be incremented and decremented, and by doing so, there can be certain actions that are taken on the execution of threads. Okay, at the end of the day, a semaphore is basically a special kind of an integer variable. Okay, it has a value like any other integer variable, and depending on the value, and depending on whether you are trying to increment or decrement this value, certain things will happen, and we will see what those things are. Okay. There are two types of semaphores. One is called a binary semaphore, and it's so named because its value can either be 0 or 1. Okay, it's integer, it's a binary value, okay, binary variable. So it can either be 0 or 1. Then you have something called a counting semaphore. Okay, its value can go from 0 to n. Okay, any value that it can take from 0 to n, and which is why it's called a counting semaphore. And they are useful for different things. Okay. A binary semaphore can be used exactly the same as a lock. Okay, if you want to use it as a lock, you can do so. It gives you the same semantics. But we'll see that it can do other things as well. Unlike locks, which are initialized to 0, typically a binary semaphore is initialized to 1. And then you can reduce its value to 0. We'll see how to do that. Okay, so we'll come back to counting semaphores soon. Let's talk about binary semaphore. Okay, so there are two methods. Like in lock, you had an acquire and a release. In a semaphore, there are two methods. There's a wait and a signal. Okay, that allow you to change the value of this semaphore. Okay, what wait does is it decrements the value of this semaphore. Okay, what signal does is it increments the value of the semaphore. Okay, so think of wait as just something that goes and decrement, but there are other things that wait does, not just decrement, but it by definition it will decrement. Okay, and signal will increment. So this is how you will use semaphores as locks. Okay, if you instead of an acquire you do semaphore dot wait, and then instead of a release you do semaphore dot signal. Okay, this code is completely identical to using locks. Okay, there is no difference semantically whatsoever. It will do exactly the same thing. Okay, here, if there is something executing the critical section, it will block. Okay, and this will cause it to get released and allow someone else to run. Okay, so this is just to show you that semaphores can do at least as much as what locks can do. And we will see that they can do some other things as well. Okay, so here is the semantics of wait. Okay, so what wait does is it decrements the value. Okay. And if the semaphore is free, which means its value was non-zero before it got decremented, then wait will just continue execution. Okay, thread will not be blocked. Okay, but if the semaphore value is not free, which means it's already zero, then that wait will cause the thread to block. Yeah, very similar to locks. If the lock is free and you call an acquire, then you grab the lock and you continue execution. If the lock is in use and you call acquire, then you block. Same thing is true here. Okay, if the semaphore is free, okay, then you get, basically you decrement it and you continue execution. The semaphore is not free, which means its value has got decremented to zero. Okay, at this point you will basically be blocked. Okay, that's the semantics of wait. Okay, what a signal does is it unblocks any process or thread that is already blocked or waiting on the semaphore, just as release would do. Okay, this is basically the reason you call it signal, is you signal the thread that is waiting on the semaphore, saying the semaphore is now available, continue execution. Is that clear what I just said? What wait and signal do? So here is the code for too much milk. We saw that code last time. Okay, that's the lock implementation. So here you basically do an acquire. If there is no milk, you buy milk and you do a release. Okay, that's your too much milk implementation using locks. Here's the same implementation using semaphores. Okay, so instead of an acquire, you put a semaphore dot wait. Instead of a release, put semaphore dot signal. Okay, and it gives you the same. So this is how you would use semaphores as an alternative to locks. Yes. Okay, question is, does it have to be a binary semaphore? If you are using the semaphore as a lock, you are using it as a binary semaphore. Okay? There is this generalization called counting semaphore that gives you other things. That's not what you want here. This is a binary semaphore. Any questions here? Okay, so here is the implementation of a semaphore class. Okay, let's see what it does. Okay, so you have a value, this is the integer value of that semaphore. You can initialize to anything. Okay, that you basically use it in the constructor. Typically, if you have a binary semaphore, it will be initialized by to 1. Okay, so then you have a wait process and you have a signal, wait method and you have a signal method. The wait method, I said, you decrement. Okay, so that's what you do, value equals value minus 1. Okay, you always decrement in the wait, you always increment in the signal. But in addition to doing that, then you check, is the value negative? If the value is negative, then you have to block. If the value is either positive or zero, then you just continue execution. But if the value is negative, then you block. So in the lock implementation or a binary semaphore implementation, initially the value is 1. The first thread that calls the wait will decrement the value to 0 and it will continue execution. The next one that calls a wait will cause the value to become negative and it will block itself from execution. Okay? So, and the signal is going to do the opposite. Okay, it will always increment, and if the value is less than or equal to 0, then it will assume, it will know that there is some thread or process on the queue. It will take that process out of the queue and it will wake it up. Now this implementation is general. Okay, although you can make it work for binary semaphores, we'll see that the exact same implementation works for counting semaphores as well. Okay, so but for now let's not worry about counting semaphores. This is just binary semaphore. Okay, now one thing I haven't done here is clearly these two things have to be atomic. Okay, so you either need to use a test and set the same guard instruction, or you need to enable and disable interrupts. Okay, I haven't shown those two things here. So you have to keep in mind that this code will not work as is. You have to make sure those things are atomic by either using some test and set or interrupts, just as we did for locks. Okay, I left those pieces out. Okay, is that clear? Any questions here? Okay, so here's an example. Okay, so here there are two processes. Okay. They are all working on the same semaphore. Okay. This process does wait, wait, signal, signal. That process does a wait and a signal. Okay. here is the initial value. We assume that is initialized to 2, which means it's not a binary semaphore. So it's initialized to 2. Initially the queue is empty. Okay, this is, these are the two things that the semaphore has. It has a value and it has a queue. So queue, the value is set to 2. In the constructor, the queue is empty. Process 1 is executing. Process 2 is executing. We'll assume that those sequence of instructions execute in this order. Okay, the first P1's wait executes and P2's wait executes. Then the second wait for P1 executes and then these three signals execute. Okay, then the question is, in this table, what happens to the value at each of these steps? What happens to the queue? Does P1 and P2 continue execution or they are blocked as a result of each of these things? Is the problem clear? Okay, so what's going to happen after you do the first wait? Does wait increment or decrement? Okay, it decrements. Okay, so what happens to value? It goes to 1. Okay, is the value negative? No. Okay, if the value is not negative, then you don't do anything. Okay, you just check if the value is negative, you block. Otherwise, you do nothing, meaning that you just continue execution. Okay, so since you don't do anything, queue remains empty. Process P1 continues execution. Okay, this wait doesn't cause it to block. Okay, P2 is still executing something. Okay, so now is the second wait. Okay, value goes to 0. Okay, does that cause P2 to get blocked? Okay, it's not negative. Okay, so P2 can continue execution. So queue remains empty. Okay, so here queue remains empty, and P1 and P2 are still executing. Okay, now here is the third wait. Okay, value goes negative. It is -1 at this point. Okay, so since this value is negative, that if condition is triggered, okay, and then P1 is blocked. Okay, it's called, put P1 on the wait queue and block it. Okay, so now the queue actually has P1. Okay, the value is -1. Queue has P1. P1 gets blocked. As a result, P2 is still executing. Okay, now P2 goes and does signal. Okay, what does signal do? Okay, it's going to increment the value. Okay, so it goes from -1 to 0. Value has gone to 0. Okay, is the if condition triggered? It's still less than 0, is less than or equal to 0. Okay, so it is triggered. So it will remove whichever process is in the queue and it will wake it up. So here the value has gone to 0, queue is emptied because you took P1 out of the queue, okay, and you woke it up. So P1 is now executing again, P2 continues to execute. Okay, there's nothing has happened to P2. Okay, now, so P1 is executing now, okay, so it can actually execute this signal. Okay, this will increment the value one more time. Okay, so value has gone back to 1, it was 0, it went back to 1, queue is empty, there's nothing to do, okay, because it, so that if condition is no longer triggered because 1 is not less than or equal to 0. Okay, so this remains empty. Okay, P1 continues to execute, P2 continues to execute. And then you have the last signal which brings it back to 2, the value. Okay, queue is still empty, P1 and P2 are executing.
So when they both execute at the same time, you don't have to worry about both of the processes.
Okay, so by execute here, that doesn't mean that they are actually running. It just means that they are not blocked. That's all it means. This, it means that if you have only one processor, one core, only one of them can actually run. Although both of these, so this execute just means they are ready to run or running. It means it's not blocked or waiting. That's all it means here. Okay, it doesn't mean that both of them are actually running and doing something. They could if it was a multi-core system. Yeah, that's still possible. Okay, in this case, we didn't want to complicate it. We just meant execute, just meant it's not blocked. So think of execute as not blocked in this case. Doesn't mean they're necessarily executing the same instruction. Yes, question.
Is blocked different from sleep?
Is blocked different from sleep? They're essentially the same thing. Sleep is just the call that causes you to get blocked. There are many other things that can cause you to get blocked. If you do read of a file, that's an IO that causes you to get blocked. If you sleep, that also causes you to get blocked. Okay. So these are all methods that will cause the same end result, which is that this will wait. Blocked means it's waiting. It's in the wait queue. Okay. So these are all things that will cause you to go into the wait queue. Okay. So essentially, they do the same thing. Any other questions here? Is this clear? Okay. So here is another example. So let's assume that you figured out how the previous one worked. So if you want to take a sheet of paper and work through this for 5 minutes. Yeah, but you can hand it in towards the end of the class. I'm going to wait for 5 minutes, let you work through it, and just when you leave the room, just hand it back to me. So you don't have to come here and give it. Weight decrements, signal increments. Okay. I'm trying to figure out how to keep both of them going at the same time. Let me write this down here. Okay, this is the sequence P1 and P2 doing weights. I'm going to put the code up if you want.
part is P1,
P2, P1. P1, P2, P1. Yes. Just do this to for simplicity rather than complicating life. Okay, 1 minute and we'll move on. So, just write your name, hand it in as you leave. Okay. So, let's move on. So, the reason I had actually put that example up, the two examples rather, was to explain the use of semaphores for doing something more than locks. Okay. So, what you basically saw in those examples was, if some process is blocked, okay, somebody else doing signal can wake it up. Yeah, that was the basic point of the example. Yeah, you wait and you get blocked. If somebody else does signal, you can wake up. Okay? You can use this simple idea to actually coordinate between threads or processes. Okay? So the second use of semaphore, the first use is to do mutual exclusion, same thing as locks. The second use of semaphores is to implement scheduling constraints. Okay? And scheduling constraint means if some process wants to do something but cannot, it will wait, and then some other process can wake it up when the condition that is waiting on becomes true. Okay. So here, for instance, if you remember, there is this Unix system call called wait PID. Okay. This call causes the process that calls wait PID to block until that process exits the system. Okay. You could implement this with a semaphore. Okay? So you can basically cause, so you initialize the value of semaphore to zero. Okay, not a positive value, but zero. So the first time anybody calls wait, if that value zero causes that threat to immediately block. Okay, because the value becomes negative, and negative values imply that you will block. Okay, and then subsequently, when the process that you are waiting on, in this case, if you are using this to implement wait PID, actually exits, you can do a signal and wake this process up explicitly. Okay, so this is a very simple example to show you that semaphores can be used to implement scheduling constraints. We'll see several examples. Okay, so this is something to keep in mind. Okay, so here is a more realistic, more complex example. We are looking at producers and consumers here. Okay, multiple producers, multiple consumers, arbitrary number of threads. Okay, you remember what producers and consumers do. Okay, so there is a buffer that shared between the producers and consumers. Okay, what does a producer do? It puts value, produces items and it puts values into the buffer. What do consumers do? They consume from the buffer. Okay. So we looked at an example of producers and consumers without any synchronization. Clearly that example doesn't work. You need synchronization. So here is how you could use semaphores to implement producers and consumers. Okay. What are the correctness property we want from producers and consumers? Okay, so assume that the buffer is of a fixed length. Okay, there are n items in the buffer. It's an array of size n. Okay, so what restrictions can we put on a producer if you have a bounded buffer? Okay. Yes, you cannot overflow the buffer. If the buffer is full, there are n items, and the producer wants to produce one more, it has to wait. It has to wait for one slot to become available. It has to wait for a consumer to consume something because the buffer is full. Okay, so buffer overflows. For producers, you want to prevent buffer overflows. Okay, so for consumer, what is the correctness property you want? Yeah.
So would take when there's nothing there.
Yeah. If the buffer is empty, there is nothing to do. Okay, you have to wait again for something, for the producer to produce something. So that's called buffer underflow. Okay, you neither want buffer overflows, neither do you want buffer underflow. Okay, so those are the two properties you want. Okay, so here are conditions where you want somebody to wait. The buffer is full, the producer should wait. If the buffer is empty, the consumer should wait. How would you do that? What could you do? Use semaphores. Yes.
We'll block it when the buffer becomes full. Or block it.
Yep.
And then unlock it. Block it. Right. So when the buffer is
empty. Right. So you could use semaphores in different ways. There are three semaphores used in this example. Okay. This is a mutex semaphore. This is a binary semaphore. This is essentially a lock. Okay. For now, ignore this. Okay. There are two other semaphores here. There is a semaphore called empty and there is a semaphore called full. Okay. As the name suggests, the semaphore full is going to block the producer. Okay. If the buffer is full. Okay. And the semaphore empty is actually, it's the other way around. The semaphore empty, sorry, is going to block the producer if the buffer is full, and the producer is full, or the names are actually reversed. So full blocks the consumers. Okay, so here is the code. Okay, so what we look at, for ignore the middle one. So just look at the empty dot wait and the full dot signal. Here you have full dot wait and empty dot signal. Okay, let's just work through that just as we worked through in the previous example of doing this waits and signals. Okay, so we will say empty is n initially, okay, and full is 0. Okay. So what does the producer do? It does empty dot wait. What does that do to the value of empty? Decrements. Okay, this is the example we just did. Okay, so this will cause this to become n minus 1. Is the producer blocked? No. Okay, so it keeps going. So let's assume the producer has and then it actually, once it continues here, you will see that it adds an item to the buffer. Okay, so let's assume that the producer has produced n items in the buffer, consumer hasn't consumed anything. Okay. This will cause the value of empty to become zero, because each time the producer is decrementing the value of empty. Okay. So empty is essentially saying, is there an empty slot? It's counting how many empty slots there are in the buffer. Okay. So when you have produced n data items, the value of empty has gone to zero. It says now there are zero empty slots in your buffer. The buffer is essentially full at this point. Okay? So if the producer now tries to produce another data item, it will do another empty dot wait. Okay? So value will go negative. Okay? This will automatically block your producer. So your producer is now prevented from moving forward because it will block them. So it cannot produce and put anything into the data into the buffer at this point. Okay, so the producer can go and produce n data items. As soon as the number of slots goes to zero, producer blocks, because that's what the semaphore is giving you. Okay, yes, you have a question.
I'm confused. Doesn't producer increment the pool?
No, the producer is actually decrementing. It is doing that here, but we'll come to that in just a moment. I'm just talking about the first. So wait is decrementing. Okay, there are two semaphores. There is a wait semaphore and a full semaphore. Ignore everything else for now. Just focus on the first instruction, which is empty dot wait. All I am pointing out here is that you can do that n times, because the value of empty was set to n. You can decrement it at most n times and continue execution, and the n plus first time you will block. And that basically means that the consumer was not running at all. Your buffer is filled up because you basically put all the n data items in the buffer. This is a bounded buffer of size n. Okay, buffer is full. So your producer shouldn't go and overwrite the buffer. You don't want the buffer overflow. Okay, is that clear? We'll come to what this does in just 1 second. We'll come to this full thing. Okay, so let's come to full. Okay. So let's say producer has produced and it's merely produced n data item. Now it cannot do anything at this point. It's blocked. Okay. Let's assume the consumer runs. Yeah, let's analyze what would happen. Okay. So let's take it from the beginning. Let's assume the consumer ran even before the producer produced anything. Okay. Let's assume just to make it more interesting, consumer started executing before the producer has even started. Okay. So producer code will run and it will do full dot wait. What's the initial value of full? It's 0. What will the wait do? It's going to decrement. Value is going to minus 1. What will that do to the consumer? It will block the consumer. Is that the right thing to do? Producer hasn't produced anything, so if the consumer runs first, you have to make it block, because there is nothing to consume. Buffer is empty. Is that clear?
So that's initially before any producer.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what the interleaving is. The code always works regardless of in what order things run. I'm just showing you example instances of when the consumer will block and when the producer will block. This code runs independent of which order the producer runs, which order the consumer runs, and I'll show you why. Okay. But just in case the consumer ran first, because we don't control in what order they run, we are actually using the mutexes to control in what order they will execute. Okay. We want the producer to produce at least one data item before the consumer can do anything. Okay. If the consumer just starts running before the producer, it will be blocked. Yeah, because it will decrement the value to minus 1, so it will cause it to block. Now suppose that the producer had actually produced one data item. Okay, let's say producer runs. Okay. So you will see that the last instruction of the producer each time is a signal. Okay. So if the producer ran first, okay, the value was 0, okay, it would just go into a signal which would cause the value to increment. So it will basically just increment it. This also tells you how many data items there are to consume. So full is telling you how many data items there are to consume. Empty is telling you how many empty slots there are in the buffer. Okay, that's what it is. Okay. So if the producer ran first, it would have incremented the value of signal. So if the consumer ran subsequently, the weight wouldn't block it. Okay, because it will just decrement this value back, okay, and it will continue to run. So in the, let's go back to the previous case. If the consumer is the first to run, okay, the value is actually 0. It makes it goes to minus 1. Okay, and this blocks the consumer. Okay, consumer cannot run because it basically started before the producer. There was nothing to consume. Okay, if the producer runs subsequently, it will produce a data item there and it will call a signal. Okay, so if you go back to the signal code, you will see that that will cause the signal to increment, okay, and since the value was less than or equal to 0, it will unblock the consumer. It knows that there is a consumer waiting. It will tell the consumer, I just produced a data item, go ahead. Okay, so if the consumer runs first and blocks, the producer will explicitly unblock it by causing this signal. Okay, this will ensure coordination. So you will see that regardless of what order there is, if the buffer is non-empty, consumers can just enter and consume data items. The buffer becomes empty and then they block, and then you have to wait for the producer to actually produce something, and this will cause it to unblock. Okay? Any questions on this? And then you will see that the last thing is empty.signal. Once you have consumed, okay, you call the signal. So in the first case where I said the producer produces n data items and it is blocked, it's waiting for an empty slot. Once the consumer runs and it calls this empty.signal, there is a blocked producer there. Okay. It will unblock it saying, I just consumed a data item, I freed up a slot, go ahead. Okay. That will unblock that producer which was waiting there. It will go in, it will add something, and then it add something to the buffer and make it full again. This is how you can explicitly control the order in which things are executing using a semaphore. This is a synchronization primitive that says, okay, this is exactly the order. Any other order will cause either the producer or the consumer to block. Okay, so you are blocking and waking someone up. So this is what I was talking about when I said you can use semaphores to do scheduling. Okay, control the order in which some things execute. So this is your producers and consumers using counting semaphores. Okay, we actually switched from binary semaphores to counting semaphores. Okay, so your semaphore values are in here. The only last thing I will say before I move wrap up today is the mutex thing. This is basically a lock, as I just said. Okay, think of this as a lock.acquire and a lock.signal. Since the buffer is a shared data structure, you want to always protect it with a lock. Okay? These two other semaphores aren't locked. They are just controlling the order of execution of the producers and consumers. So you still want a lock to protect the buffer. That is what you do with a mutex semaphore. Okay, so that's the third thing here. So this should tell you how to implement multiple producers, multiple consumers. Okay, this code even works if there are n producers and m consumers. Doesn't we just looked at an example of one producer, one consumer, but this code generalizes to arbitrary numbers. It doesn't matter how many there are. Every producer has to check, is there an empty slot? If so, it runs, otherwise it blocks. Every consumer checks, is there something to consume? If so, it runs, otherwise it blocks. Okay, and producers wake up consumers, consumers go wake up producers. Okay, so let's stop here. We'll continue next time with monitors.